We could always run our own scam. Give us one Bitcoin and we'll give you two back.
We promise.
We promise.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Human Reaction. We are glad you are here. This is your weekly source for independent commentary on cultural news and politics, where it's always our mission, every week, multiple times a week, to give you the knowledge that you need to cut through media misdirection and resist the mononarrative and develop mental models that are going to help you digest the news and understand what you're seeing in the world and prevent yourself from being manipulated. We got a great show today. For everybody who is new here, or if you're not new here, please do like, subscribe to the channel, wherever it is that you might be watching. And of course, if you would like to become a member and support the show financially, we greatly appreciate it. Go to humanreactionpod.com to find out how you can do that. David, what are we talking about today?
Well, we're skipping Kyle, but fine.
Whoops.
I didn't want to talk anyways.
Kyle, what are we talking about today?
I just wanted to show you guys. Adam put a little diagram, and I think it's very helpful for what we will be talking about here. You have someone has done a thing, and then you have to ask yourself, are they on your side? If yes, then it's fine. If no, then they're a bastard.
Well, this is accurate. This is accurate.
That accurately summarizes what we're about to summarize.
Oh, yeah. Also, don't forget our members, because we have our swag drop here.
Yes.
DM David, and there is a code that you will get for the swag drop.
Yes.
Especially for our high members that are the lifeblood of this channel. They get their free drop of the year.
That's right. It's coming out very soon. And where do you DM them? You do that on our Discord server. The link is in the description of this video, so please do join that. It's a great conversation. That's where you'll find awesome memes like this one from Adam, and that is where members can message David to get the code to go to our website and get your free swag drop for the year.
If you are a small business owner looking for exponential growth, you have to connect with Adam Thune at Intellectual Patriots. He will revolutionize your business game and help you get to the next level. Adam can streamline your business practices and advertising strategies to improve your bottom line. His expertise in data engineering means he can build you the systems you need to collect and analyze market data. His mission is to provide you with invaluable insights to fuel your success. From grant writing and business proposals to digital systems integrations, even AI management, Intellectual Patriots is a one-stop shop for cutting-edge solutions. Don't wait another second. Visit intelpatriots.com to learn more. That's intelpatriots.com.
This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
So this week, today, we're talking about, is MAGA at war? Question mark.
Yes.
I can't H1 believe it. We're going to be talking about immigration before 2025 even starts. Like, he's not in office yet. There's nothing anyone can do, but goddamn, we're going to have a debate about immigration right now.
Yes, and for those who don't get the H1 joke, it's not a SARS joke. It's a visa joke, and we'll get to it in just a moment.
Yes. So on Christmas, Elon responded to a guy with a simple tweet. It's only two sentences long. The original tweet says, generally curious, are there any actual instances where qualified native-born Americans couldn't get jobs in tech because foreigners took them all? I'd be surprised if it's true, because at any given point, there are hundreds of thousands of unfilled jobs in tech. And Elon responds, there's a permanent shortage of excellent engineering talent. It is a fundamental limiting factor in Silicon Valley, with 7 million views. So he messaged that on Christmas, and it blew up. It got huge, to the point where, you know, I mean, in short, he's saying that there's a demand here that foreign workers supply. And that became very controversial.
Why?
Well, some people believe that that is an excuse to pay people less, right, by importing other labor.
I see. But really what he's saying is there aren't enough native born Americans who are excellent at these roles to fill all the demand for this type of work?
Yes. For specifically in his case, he's saying excellent engineers. Sure. Right? And, you know, obviously it got back, and as it's kind of circling in this area, he defended himself in this follow-up tweet is, your understanding of the situation is upside down and backwards. Of course, my companies and I would prefer to hire Americans, and we do, as that is much easier than going through the incredibly painful and slow work visa process. However, there is a dire shortage of extremely talented and motivated engineers in America. This is not about handing out opportunities from some magical hat. You don't get it. This is blindingly obvious when looking at NBA teams, as the physical differences are so obvious to see. However, the mental differences between humans are far bigger than the physical differences. And people got offended by that. Be like, you're calling us retarded.
You're calling us dumb. Fuck you.
Right.
Spaceman.
So we've gone from the Mexicans are taking our jobs to the Indians are taking our jobs, right?
Yes. They're taking our jobs.
They're taking our jobs. It is funny because I think on multiple occasions on this podcast, I have stated, and I've just been this way for 2 years, especially because I pay a lot of attention to the tech field, how advanced Indian Americans are at this moment. And now everything's just like blown up.
It's had its expression in politics, right? We have the rise of Indian ethnic politicians taking up a larger and larger space of our discourse on the right, which is an interesting thing. It's something that we celebrated, right? And now it's kind of having this strange new effect. It's like, well, you guys are all new here. And so a lot of people are taking offense to this kind of criticism, and it's like an emotional offense. So Vivek came in to kind of back up Elon with this tweet that went super viral, 70 million views.
70 million.
Go down on it, actually. Let's get a fresh look, because that's what it was a little while ago.
110
million views.
Insane.
And it's kind of a longer post, but I'm not going to read it out. But in short, American culture focuses on the wrong things. It rewards the wrong things in our culture, specifically around young people, right? Not our adult culture, not all cultures in America, but he's saying the overall architecture can look this way, that it rewards popularity, athletic accomplishment, beauty, aesthetics, your ability to like work a group and have lots of friends, more so than it does math Olympiads, spelling bee champions, things like that. And that's the reason why Asian Americans, South Asian Americans specifically, but, you know, in general, Asian Americans are outperforming the white population in the United States.
Well, let me just like, I'll just take some excerpts from this because I think it'll help for people that haven't seen it. If you're not one of the 110 million people that have seen this. Some of the examples that I think hit people quite a bit was a culture that venerates Corey from Boy Meets World or Zack and Slater over Screech and Saved by the Bell or Stefan over Steve Urkel in Family Matters will not produce the best engineers. He goes on to say more movies like Whiplash, fewer reruns of Friends, more math tutoring, fewer sleepovers, more weekend science competitions, fewer Saturday morning cartoons, more books, less TV, more creating, less chilling, more extracurriculars, less hanging out at the mall. You kind of get the sense of where that, and then all the downstream that comes from that, right?
And that he is a Gen Xer, man. Those are some Gen X examples.
Right? This is Gen X takeover right now.
I know. I was like, holy shit, Saved by the Bell? Wow, that's a callback.
Yeah. But it's also one of these things, like, if you've ever hung out with, like, you know, immigrant kids growing up or something like that, there is kind of this mentality. And he comes from an immigrant family. You know, he's first gen, or is that his parents immigrated here? Then that makes him first gen.
Yeah,
or is it
right.
That makes him second gen.
Yeah. They're immigrants. Yeah. He's a first generation American.
Yeah. So he's coming from that culture, and, you know, he did come up and become a billionaire afterwards. Yeah. Right. But in that kind of milieu, there's a very, like, there's the tiger mom, Asia kind of fanaticism of, like, you know, browbeating the kids into studying harder and stuff. Like, we've all experienced that. And that is a big piece of that culture, where oftentimes Americans, there's a laziness, I think, that settles in. And there's a not taking the taking the opportunities in front of you for granted.
Sure.
Where the other people will take those opportunities. Right.
I mean, I would kind of put it in the cycle of civilizations framework, where, you know, you go from abundance to complacency. Like, America has been such an abundant nation for, you know, the baby boomer generation, that the subsequent generations have been the beneficiaries of that, and we haven't necessarily had to work as hard. So when, you know, immigrant families come over and they want to achieve, they're extremely hard on their kids. Like, I mean, I see that thread kind of coming through here. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, there's that. I mean, one of the, we actually got a tweet from our boy Liam here, kind of updating it for the Gen Z crowd. So I think they understand. And the kind of the short of it is, quote, "The issue for kids these days isn't TV and sleepovers. It's divorce rates, social media, wokeism, bad diets, and porn." Right, which is, I think, a reasonable kind of statement, right? You're sure. Saying these Gen Z kids graduate college now, right, in the last couple of years, and what are the distributions of engineers versus other things compared to the supply of engineers proportionally within that market that a native or, I guess, domestic labor isn't fulfilling because they don't have the same amount of pressure to go for STEM areas. So is that a real thing? Is that a real cultural criticism? It seems like it is. It seems like something that if you put into the Black community and you said, well, one of the problems with the Black community, why they underperform on economics, is that they don't have the same degree of pressure culturally to perform in school and do the things that lead to economic prosperity. That's, you can find videos of Ben Shapiro getting applause from large conservative audiences making this point. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden, when we apply it to white America, it causes this, like, how dare you sort of backlash that's happening.
Yeah.
And that's only part of it. That's, I don't want to use that to say that that's where all of the criticism comes from. Some of it's very intellectual, very much like, well, H-1B has these problems, and here's all the things that we're talking about. Now, why does this have to do with H-1B? It's because H-1B is a particular capped immigration program, specifically work immigration program. So this isn't how you become a permanent resident. This isn't how you become a citizen. This is how you come to America, work here for 3 years legally. That's all that is, right?
And it doesn't have a pathway to citizenship attached to it, or?
No, not automatic. Nothing that you can apply for a green card status to become a permanent resident as an H-1B visa holder, but anyone can do that, right? You don't have to be an H-1B visa holder to do that.
I see.
Some do that, but there's additional vetting that goes to do that. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So the broad thing that just to understand about H-1Bs is it requires, first, you have to have an offer from an employer. Second, a bachelor's degree in a specialty occupation. Positions must require a theoretical and practical application of a body of highly specialized knowledge and typically a bachelor's degree or higher in a specific specialty or its like international equivalent. That's the minimum requirements for entry to the occupation. So most of these people are entries to these occupations. So their biggest market competitor are other fresh grads. Mm. So you don't want to compare H-1B visa holders to established engineers who have 10 years of experience.
Right.
That's the sense in which I think where a lot of the anecdotes that are coming from that say, like, well, I was replaced by an H-1B visa holder. Well, you could have also been replaced by a brand new engineer domestically, because they demand different wage rates, mm-hmm. right? If this is your first year into engineering, you're going to demand a wage rate that's probably $76,000 annual right now for a salary. That's about the same as H-1B visas are being required or are being asked for.
So there was what I saw there seemed to be some controversy around this conversation over that very thing, the compensation, where it's like, oh, if you're looking for this excellent talent, right? These exceptional engineers, they're going to be paid very highly, but they're looking, people are, you know, going through looking at H-1B visa holders that are working for, you know, X or SpaceX or you know, whatever, a variety of companies. And they're seeing that they're making these like, you know, high, you know, 70 to 90K a year kind of salary. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, you know, these are not the wages you would pay someone who's an exceptional engineer. Is that the misunderstanding that people are having?
Well, the exceptional engineer part is Elon's standard. That's not the standard of H-1B. H-1B just says engineers. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So the kind of the sleight of hand being done there is not looking at who the H-1B visas actually are and what the laws are around this. It is illegal right now in code to pay H-1B visa holders less than domestic employees. Right. Hmm. So the employer must pay H-1B, which is at least the required wage, which is defined, which is higher than the prevailing wage or the employer's actual wage. So it actually says H-1B visa holders have to be paid higher than what you'd pay a domestic worker. in order to bring them over. Now, this is all based upon a calculation of the prevailing wage, which is in the absence. So say you have, you're hiring an engineer and you only have three. So you have to compare them to the engineer's pay in the marketplace. And what companies are accused of doing, and this is probably a real weakness in H-1B for sure, is they're accused of being selective about their data points to calculate their prevailing wage for their area, time, and the qualifications for the job.
So they're maybe artificially suppressing that wage so they can pay H-1B visa holders
by
less.
Using tricky math. That's one way to think about
sure.
it. But that doesn't seem, and that can happen in any individual case, while the average actually is different, right? If you look at the entire data set, you're going to see a very different set of outcomes. A couple of things here, too, to note is kind of like the overall impact. So one of the things we're seeing is all of these screenshots of H-1B visa applications, meaning the employer saying, I want to hire somewhere in this range.
Because this is all public data. And so, and people discovered that it's all public data. So they're going and finding the company that they want to try to dunk on,
right?
As like, oh, you did H-1B, you know, that whole thing,
or the program itself. Like someone found a someone found one for a stripper, an H-1B visa for a stripper. And I was like, okay, that's important to note because that is not an actual H-1B visa holder. That's a company trying to use the system.
Sure,
right?
That's hilarious.
Yeah, right.
Hey, look, you know, some exotic talent is necessary in that industry, right?
And I want to correct one thing, too. I said 3 years.
Diverse industry.
H-1B visas are 3 years minimum, and then you have an extended stay that requires another application process that can increase it up to 6 years without going back home.
Gotcha.
So that's what we're talking about. What we're not talking about is new permanent residents. We're not talking about people becoming citizens. We're just talking about people who work here who have citizenships in other countries.
Got it.
All right, so there's also an H, that's the H-1B non-exempt. The H-1B exempt is the bulk of H-1B, which is a very interesting part of this that seems to be getting lost in the dialogue here. Most of H-1B is actually in the exempt status, especially in the since 2020. There's an explosion. We're talking about 300,000 people total, and it jumps up, 200,000 people, and it jumps up to 500,000 people in that time frame. It's a huge jump. This data set doesn't show it, but when you go back further, it's really unique. And I can't explain that quite yet, but it kind of explains it if you look at what H-1B exempt is. So what it is it's for other industries that do have higher education, usually a master's degree or higher, in an intended field with a minimum wage of $60,000. Now, that's really low. So people are pointing to that, like, that's a low wage. What's going on here? Well, that's because most of these institutions are that use H-1B exempt are universities, colleges, education, nonprofit organizations, and government research organizations, affiliated related nonprofits to education organizations. We're thinking like the Aspen Institute or other kind of like affiliated George Mason University has their affiliated nonprofits that do research outside of that, but they raise money independently from the university, thinking like Mercatus Institute or something like that.
So why does that necessitate this lower wage rate?
Because generally nonprofits pay less than for-profits.
Gotcha.
Right. And we're not talking engineers here. We're talking social scientists, economists. Mm-hmm. We're talking, there are some that are talking about that are those, right? So like you're doing research in AI, you're a software engineer, you would fall into this exempt category, which has no cap, which is much larger. That's why it's grown so much.
I see.
So you have the 60,000 with an additional 20,000, so 85,000 total capped amount. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about engineers. So when Elon is saying there's a deficit here and it's difficult to get these people, that's because you can only fill up that cap of 85,000 and the demand is far larger. Not to mention the domestic supply and how much is that, which is a much harder question to know.
So the outrage over Americans, you know, native-born Americans being replaced by H-1B non-exempt visa holders is sort of misplaced because there's only 85,000 of them in a country of 350 million. So that's obviously not like an extraordinary percentage of the available workforce.
And that's one of the things that's kind of become kind of a background issue to this is that the election was won on a giant consensus on illegal immigration. Right. And now the fight is like, OK, so what about legal immigration? Mm-hmm. What are our rules and how do we reform that? Should we reform that? And there's a side that's saying, and I'll define them as the populist right. I think that word works better. That's saying zero immigration. because I think that is reflective of a populist mindset at the moment. And then there's the libertarian nationalist, which is saying, which is the kind of the Vivek crowd, which is
in the tech crowd. Like the tech those crowd. Are all the like blended in together. It's like this techno libertarian nationalist thing. Mm-hmm.
And people are saying tech right, which I think is right, but that's not, I think there's a little bit more that might narrow some other issues. So I'm saying libertarian nationalist for now. That is saying, well, we need to fulfill these roles so that we can become the strongest, best, most competitive country in the world.
Sure.
Right? So, and I want to note this section on pay. So if you go to this thread right here, this is the H-1B data. So this is accepted H-1B visa holders. This isn't proposals. This is who actually has it. So this is the total amount. This starts in 2020, but you'll see that it grows, 80, almost a million people coming in. Now look where the cap level is. Right there. So the cap is just that bottom. Go back. That cap is just the bottom. Now, everyone above that is exempt.
Yeah. And then that's what this is, right?
No, this is the wage distribution. So this is how wage, and this is kind of a harder one to look at because it's not ordered on the right. But if you go to the next one, Kyle, that's by job application category. You can see most of them are computer science engineers. This includes exempt. So most of the engineers that are going into universities are still at that level of engineers. So they're easily crossing the 60,000K cap, especially when you go to the next one. You can see the total average. So that middle band is the standard deviation from the average, right? So right there at 120,000 is where we're sitting at for your average H-1B. So you do have some distribution to the left.
Wait, hold on. I'm sorry. I'm seeing the band between 80 and 120.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So that's where most people are coming in on H-1B.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Right. And so people are saying that isn't, that's
this poor outlier over here. Yeah,
So
that guy got screwed.
Network and computer systems administrator. He probably knows who he is too. He's like, that's me.
He's like,
Well, that's actually what an employer asked for in that area. So that could be funny mathematics, right? Where they are fixing the, and there's a case to be made that, and there's legal liability that goes with that. Like your HR department should exist to make sure you don't accrue legal liability for proposing an H-1B visa that is below the prevailing wage of an area, right? So if you're that far out of the distribution, that's probably a case. Now, who actually prosecutes that? You know, that's up to the federal government to do, and for employees to file a lawsuit. So that's one of the things is like, this is, it's kind of funny because it's, you can't make it illegaler, right? It's already illegal. So how to make it better would be somewhere in which you're reforming the program. But people are saying, well, this program is just irredeemably bad because it's being used this way. When I'm not exactly sure, if you compare this, if you go to the Statista, this is the wage rates for new graduate degrees in the United States in 2024 by discipline. If you notice, your first level of engineering is probably at, on average, this is just saying on average, this isn't saying this is what any individual is, across the entire country, because that's what the actual area we're talking about here, is $76,000 salary starting engineers.
So that's fresh out of school.
Yeah.
You're going to expect to make somewhere in this ballpark.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Computer science, 74. Math and science is 71.
Which is within the band of the income distribution we just looked at.
Yeah.
Right? So are they being paid less? Well, the aggregate data doesn't necessarily suggest that. But that said, there are imperfections in the data on every single level, right? We don't. These are averages, so they're not telling you any individual story. They're only telling you the mathematical average. You're looking at the tails on either end can pull that out and make that less. But if you look at the distribution, it's fairly consolidated with a couple exceptions, outliers. And those outliers might be a case that's illegal. So if it's already illegal to have outliers to that degree, maybe the government's not doing their job. Maybe there's many other explanations there that could be real and good criticisms of H-1B. But I'm looking at it, I'm saying, I'm not sure if what you're saying is that there's a systems case here, right? You do have anecdotal case. You do have individual cases that could be true. But I'm not sure that that's really building the case yet. Once you look at the data beyond the anecdotes, that it's like the program's corrupt and terrible.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing too, is we have Elon and Vivek both stating that there are plenty of problems with H-1B as a system, and those need to be fixed, stamp out the fraud, stamp out all the abuse, yada, 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 do all those things. But the other side just kind of ignoring that. And there's like, you just want your H-1B immigrants. And it's like, no, like they're and Vivek said on the campaign trail a long time ago, he was talking about this as an issue that needs to be solved, but not necessarily just getting rid of the entire program, because that is kind of where we've gone right now. And this is an area where I've always hated the immigration argument, because the immigration dialect has always become like, do we want infinite immigrants or zero immigrants? And my attitude is, no, we should be having a conversation about good immigrants versus bad immigrants,
right?
Regardless. But like, and but the unfortunate nature of our politics right now is it's either infinite or zero. And that's kind of where we're at right now.
So to be clear, at the same time that Donald Trump was saying we should take everyone who graduates with a bachelor's degree and give them a visa, Vivek was saying we should gut H-1B, right? That was the dialogue that was happening this year.
Yeah.
Well, so, and what he means by gut H-1B, he's saying the problem is it's done by group and not by individual. And what we should do is not have a cap at group. What we should do is we should find the best at individuals and bring them here to work on H-1B with no cap. So we're eliminating people not as a group, you know, like saying no people from India, which is what the kind of Christian right is saying, right? Because they damage our cultural order. It doesn't matter what the salary rate is. What matters is the culture, which is another valid part of the argument, right? And then there's the, and then there's, you know, Vivek saying, well, okay, the problem there is you're not giving the best talent in, and that should be the goal of this program. And so what we need is a program that assesses their contribution in total, both economically, culturally, whatever.
Sure.
Right.
One of the things that I've seen around this on X was that there are companies that will go overseas and recruit people under H-1B, bring them to the United States. They facilitate all their housing, and they actually create the contract with a given company for X salary rate and then pay the employee less than that. Okay. And in some cases there, I was reading, you know, there are cases where they're putting like 15 to 20 people in a single house, you know, housing them together in like less than standard living conditions, I have to assume. And then basically by the thread I was reading, sort of abusing them by you know, taking a lot off the top of what they're getting paid, dramatically reducing the amount they're actually taking home.
Because they're paying for the business is paying for their housing?
Is that
the assumption?
I suppose, but and they're making, from what it looks like, a lot of money doing this. So there are companies that are physically just set up, like basically to, if you want to say it in this way, traffic, you know, employees into the U.S. and then, you know, pay them less than maybe some of these rates are suggesting the averages are, because that's what the contracts are written for. Sure. It's like, yeah, maybe it's $120,000, $150,000, but maybe they're getting paid half of that or two thirds of that.
Yeah, well, that would be illegal, according to H-1B visa regulations that they currently set. You're not allowed to treat them different than your domestic employees.
What, I mean, is it...
Right, even in terms of workplace environment. Like, you have all the rights that, as an H-1B visa holder, you have all of the employee rights that any domestic American does.
Right, for sure.
Like, equally, right? So if I hire two people as an accountant and I treat one like dog shit...
Well, I'm not saying there's any like mistreatment per se.
No. I mean, just in terms of work standards, right? I require one to do 70 hours of work a week and the other one to do 40.
Right.
I'm opening myself up to liability. Now, that can only happen. That doesn't happen by magic of just making it illegal. It happens by a civil process to find guilt individually on that individual and on that company. So it's possible. And that could be an example of abuse that's already illegal, or they're using the math to rig the system, which can maybe be regulated better. I don't know. One of the things about this is it's on a theoretical level, you can envision a better state, but to actually implement that in code that creates that better state is a whole different question. I don't know what that would look like at the moment. There's a lot of work that needs to be done to get there. And I think that's a valuable part of this conversation, right? Is exposing what are the actual abuses of the program so that you can come up with a code solution to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and there are, and we've kind of gotten through that arc right now of like problem definition, like fighting about the problem and then like trying to get to a solution. And I think that's actually, as of recording, where we're at right now. Sorry, guys, I forgot to mute.
Yeah, you don't have an excuse anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So where's the conversation going from here?
Well, I do want to try to get the point of view from the populist faction.
Yeah, because there's a lot of different variables and a lot of different angles being had, and it's probably not appropriate to lump everything in together on either side of this.
Right.
Because there's a lot of different viewpoints, a lot of different interests that are all being at play right here, right?
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a moment ago, David, that there was the view that Indian Americans or Indian immigrants specifically are damaging the culture in some way. That's maybe the populist view. So you said the Christian.
I think the Christian view. Nationalist view. Yeah.
What's the justification for that?
They're not Christian.
That's it.
Yeah. Well, and we're a Christian country, right? Is that that's the case? Is like America is a Christian country with Christian norms and values. And when you bring over more people of that sort, they're going to change your values, which is. I mean, that's a group analysis. That could be true on the group level, but is it true for any individual is a different question. And that's the difficulty of the dialogue, right? Is you're just dealing with low resolution heuristics rather than something that you can ground in evidence for any individual or in like some reason to believe it about any individual. And the immigration process is done largely by the individual, right? It's this guy for this job.
Right? But this group of sort of like Christian American people who are objecting to this are probably seeing it through the lens of, well, we've had this flood of illegal immigration over the southern border, and that's been deleterious to our culture. And we've got the Springfield eating the cat situation and like all of these things that are probably creating a hair trigger in this instance as well.
Right.
Yeah. And because, and that's where I think I have sympathy for this side of the argument is I think that there is an argument to be had about the cultural aspect of immigration, right? Like I think we've been seeing that with the mass flooding of illegal immigration. But part of the thing of like assuming you believe that maybe more than zero immigrants should exist in the country. Let's take that radical position here right now. Part of the process of legal immigration should be a process of assimilation and getting people like embedded into the culture and converting people to your culture. It's almost like a religious practice because this is kind of religious in a sense, right? And that would be part of the process. I see an extreme disconnect with the. It's like they're looking at people doing the legal channels and who are kind of assimilating into the system. They're viewing them as the exact same way of just a mass flood of refugees coming in with no assimilation process. And that's where it's like they're just lumping it all in together. And that's where I disagree with the kind of the populist right in this sense right now, because I'm more on the Elon Vivek side of this argument.
And I think this is really becomes clear when you look at any individual from that demographic in public discourse and the way that I think this has been articulated. And I think the Ann Coulter Vivek interview from this year articulates well, I think, that objection and how they're seeing politics and culture as downstream of like connected in this way that would disqualify Vivek simply because he's Hindu.
I too am a fan of yours. I'm going to make a point of disagreeing with you so that it will be fun. You are so bright and articulate, and I guess I can call you articulate since you're not an American black. Can't say that about them. That's derogatory. And that was a great opening segment. Lots of things to talk about there. Oh, and I agreed with many, many things you said during, in fact, probably more than most other candidates when you were running for president. But I still would not have voted for you because you're an Indian. We'll get back to that.
Wow.
Check out the full interview for the context. And it's a very interesting discussion. And Vivek comes off as a class act.
They spent like 45 minutes talking about it, if I remember. I listened to that a long time ago.
Yeah.
So. Can you summarize the way Vivek responded to that?
Just like, I'm hearing you. I think you're wrong. You know, but basically her case is because America was founded by white men of a particular, you know, ethnic background and values that go along with that as a group. Your leaders should embody that in order to keep it going, to persist, because we don't want it to become a country that is embodied by different values.
Well,
that places the group in charge of values, not Vivek in charge of his own values. So it is true that you are informed by your group, but the ultimate decider is the individual, in my view, right? That's the Misesian in me says that like human action is the volitional human action is the anchor that you are best and most reliably measuring something real, something that isn't an assumption on my part about your group identity, right? So because he belongs to the group identity of Hindu, he is disqualified in Inkalter's mind from holding authority in the country because he has the wrong group identity rather than his own individual policy points of view, philosophical points of view, which she says she agrees with more than the other candidates.
That's insane to me.
Well, and that's the thing.
That's the Christian right.
Vivek is probably better at articulating classical Western values than most of the quote-unquote classical Westerners in America today. And like we were all fans of Vivek. We were team Vivek, right? We had the hats. I wish I brought mine. But like in that's just kind of the truth. And it's like, yes, he comes from a Hindu background, but he also was like educated in Christian culture and things like that because he was first generation and he assimilated. His family assimilated into the culture right now. But they can't overlook that. And that's why he's probably never going to be president unless there's some drastic change that happens in American culture right now. But he's going to always have to be kind of this guy on the sidelines, you know, throwing in his bombs and kind of articulating and writing and doing all the, and doing his podcasting and Doge and stuff like that for the time being, because the American right just not going to adopt that.
Do you think that the generational shift as the boomers become less of the dominant voting block from an age perspective, do you think that will shift that attitude in the country?
I once thought so. I'm not so sure now.
Why?
I think the broadening of discourse on the right has enabled a certain set of people to become more influential who are more than willing to engage in racial identity politics in a pro-white stance. And Christian nationalism is on the rise in the sense of like there's more people saying the problem with our culture, the degeneracy of our culture is anchored in our lack of Christian values. And if we want to solve those problems, even if you agree with all the libertarian points of view, but you want a society, an ordered society on top of that, that has strong culture to govern people's relationships. You're going to that is pulling people into that. Well, if you're not Christian, you don't really belong here. Point of view. I think that's real. I mean, it seems, and it's not real on the level that there's like, and I've looked for this. I looked really hard for like major figures who are willing to articulate that out loud. But I think that's a real phenomena. That's happening, and if that's happening on the base, it's articulating itself in a very more sophisticated intellectual level on the higher end, like Dan Cernovich kind of.
Mike.
Man, why do I think I'm Dan? I don't know why. I want him to be a Dan. He's got that gorilla mindset. He just looks like a Dan to me.
Well, I don't know if I would use Mike as the example because he is the gorilla mindset. He's just looking at it pure game theory. Like, I don't think he's... I think it's probably better better to use somebody like a Laura Loomer as the example, even though she's not...
She's Jewish.
Nor is she very articulate or intellectual.
She to me has been kind of, from what I've seen in the discourse, really been like the rallying of the troops, kind of getting the base moved on this.
Against
more so than anybody.
Yeah.
And her exact position is zero immigrants, legal or illegal. Like I just heard her on a Twitter Spaces last night saying that.
Yeah. This seems to me like, you know, in light of all of our woke right episodes and the thinking around that, this seems to me like to be the real instantiation, the growing of what I would really call the woke right. Right. Basically, it's like it's a response to the woke left, which would advocate for, you know, unlimited immigration and you know, all the things that they advocate for. This is like we've kind of discussed prior to recording, like DEI for white people. Well, the conversation is going on here.
I have had multiple people personally tell me that if a white DEI program is what's needed to reverse course on things, that they are completely for it.
That's insane.
I've had like more than one person have said this directly to me.
Well, that's the difference between the ends justified and the means thinking. Right. In order to correct historical past, we have to go the opposite direction versus first principles thinking, which says the unequal treatment of people in this way that biases against whites is wrong. So we should get rid of that and allow people to compete on a meritocracy.
Right.
To the greatest degree you can. It's not going to be perfect. It's going to be more meritocratic because you're not choosing based upon ethnic group. You're choosing based upon contribution.
Right.
Well, there's a thing, too, where it's like so much of the MAGA movement was like, all of these systems have kind of screwed over our people. And the attention is not being, let's build better systems. It's becoming, there's becoming this resentful racial energy, this identitarian energy, and like quasi DEI stuff that's starting to
Let's use the system against the other side now in retribution for whatever wrongs might have been committed.
Well, because like there's a valuable question is like, are the American systems not producing good enough engineers or enough? Why is that? Maybe there's a question that needs to be had. Maybe we need some engineering to fix that.
Well, hey, and that's what Vivek is saying. He's saying that you could if you just changed your culture in these important ways.
And maybe we should look at the American university system, which has been rotted from the inside out by DEI, which has removed the incentive for people to get degree. I mean, this is a whole other topic that goes into like financial aid and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But like we're encouraging people to get, you know, cultural studies degrees and all these random bullshit topics that don't have real economic value like engineering.
So much so that Peter Thiel, you know, who's part of the tech side of this, like, I don't think he's weighed in on this, but he's in that tech group there. He has an entire fund dedicated to funding people who did not go to college. Yeah. That's how bad colleges are right now, right?
And I want to note that that is a major narrative here justifying the ending of H-1B. Because whites have been discriminated in DEI programs, we should end H-1B, is the case. Now, because it's saying this, that, and this isn't direct DEI, maybe it's better because it's not a direct DEI just empowering whites based on ethnic status, but it is saying we're going to eliminate their competition in the workforce that comes internationally because they've been historically discriminated against in the last, you know, 10 years or something like that.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah.
That's kind of the thing here is just like, I'm just anti-DEI. I don't care what race it's for. That's just all it comes down to.
I'm against using the system to oppress anybody based on racial, cultural lines, left or right.
Well, that's what egalitarianism is supposed to mean, right? It's supposed to mean judging people based upon their individual merit, not their group identity.
Right.
What it's become meaning is equal outcomes so that we lift up the bottom and the Rawlsian influence on our culture and around egalitarianism.
Well, and there's also a thing here too, and maybe it's not kosher to say here, but maybe there's an argument that a lot of people there's too many benefits and people are getting overpaid. maybe there's an argument to be had there.
I think people who are qualified engineers with long time working histories that demand a higher wage are resentful anytime anyone new comes into that workplace and outbids them for a lower wage. That's true for boomers not liking young people entering the workplace, as it is for outsiders coming in from overseas. Now, the question is like, and I'm gonna try to steel man the populace right here, as they're saying, well, the country is a country. It's a nation that means something. And that meaning something is in part saying we're going to organize things for us first. We have this clip from Charlie Kirk that I think does a good job articulating as well, because maybe I'm not doing the best job of it, of saying, well, this is the large philosophical point of view that they're trying to make. And they're saying they're not making the distinction anymore between illegal immigration and legal immigration. They're making this point as its own, like, ipso facto starting point axiom for the movement of America First.
Of our social contract. And it sounds good. Let's just let more H-1B workers in. But what about the 23-year-old that went to University of Washington and studied computer science at the UW Computer Science Department? Shouldn't he be given preference above someone who could do the work for far less? It is about priorities, and it's not about what Charlie Kirk wants. It's not about what other people want out there. And I have friends on both sides of this debate. It's very simple. It's what the American people wanted. And the American people overwhelmingly voted for less immigration and the prioritization of the American children and the American worker, not the American oligarch. This is a...
Well, I don't know that that's overwhelmingly what Americans voted for is less immigration.
It's more so a less illegal immigration.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
And you have to differentiate.
I think that depends how much. That's what the base of Republicans wanted. Yeah. I think you show up to your average Pachyderm meeting, man, and you say, I want more legal immigration, they're going to be pissed.
Well, look, I think it all has to be it does have to be separated. I know you're not arguing against that. You're trying to steel man this.
Well, there might even be an argument of less illegal immigration, but there should probably be a process.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Well, and that's where it's like the constraints here, right? Is like, okay, you have to have above zero. So what's the bottom level? And like there has to become a discourse to say, okay, zero is not acceptable because it's bad strategy, right? Because it's just because it's bad economics, because it doesn't fit the other social conditions we're in that allow us to promise the other things that the America First movement also promised, which is like high economic growth and prosperity.
Right.
Right. If you trade those things out, I don't think you're actually going to win, because I don't think the American public, even the Republicans themselves, want a world where we're less innovative, less competitive, and less able to, you know, fulfill engineering jobs to solve problems for people.
Well, and it's just, maybe I'm the radical for thinking the compromise position is somewhere between zero and infinite. maybe that's a radical take in this moment. I don't. Apparently, everybody that has that take needs to be deported this instantly, if I'm to be reading Twitter correctly.
Back to Canada with you.
I am a dreamer. I was an anchor baby.
That's different than dreamers. But yeah.
I'm one of those wonky terms. I don't know which one I am, but I'm one of those.
I find it incredibly ironic that libertarians are called isolationist for wanting to get out of wars. Meanwhile, we have this contingent of the populist right saying basically that they want to be economically isolationist. They want to cut themselves off from immigration, from welcoming other people from other countries who are highly skilled, who can benefit this country. And then it also trickles over into the tariff conversation.
Well, and that's the question begging. This is an important thing for Elon, Vivek, us to answer, which is, Do fresh college graduates deserve to compete against the world? Do they have a right to a government that forces businesses to prefer them over others? What is the right there? And because it has to boil down, you can't use economic arguments to overcome moral arguments. It subverts.
Yeah.
So what is the moral case for an international market of labor?
Well, I think as an individual business owner, I have the right to find labor wherever I want it.
No, you don't.
Why not?
Because they have a right to a job.
No, they don't.
Yeah. Where does the idea that you have a right to a job come from?
I don't know.
FDR.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, this is all nonsensical. Yeah. Like, there's no right to a job or right to employ or whatever. Like, this is all nonsensical. I thought conservatives were supposed to care about the Constitution, and that's where all the rights come. There's nothing about this in the Constitution. Right?
The Constitution does not give a solid basis for any immigration restrictions on the federal level. That's actually a court decision.
Interesting.
It has a right to define naturalization, meaning when you become a citizen, but not immigration. Very different. And these are traditional legal categories that were changed in the late 1800s in response to German and Irish immigration.
Bastards.
And Asian immigration, to be clear. Asian immigration in the West. I mean, really, it started out with California not wanting as many Asians.
I also want to make a case here is that us and Elon and Vivek, we're much more in line with Trump's actual positioning.
Yeah.
Too. Because, like, this is the funny thing about Trump and how he just has broken everybody's brains over the last 8 years. Of his friends and his enemies all have these fantasy positions around him about how, like, he's this zero immigration guy. No, he's a zero illegal immigration guy. He has always been for reforming the legal process. Like, it's like, make a wall and put a bouncer in front of it. Like, that's been kind of his position.
Big beautiful door right? Big in the door. Wall.
Yeah. Like, it's not just like, we got to gun down everybody that's trying to cross, you know, or like, even legally speaking. Yeah. Like there's a bouncer and there should be a verification process that happens so that we can recruit the top talent. That has always been his case. And it's not just like that we should have zero immigration at all, which has always been kind of the left and kind of the lefty libertarians have always put that on him. That's never been his position. In the 8 years that he's been running for office and doing this thing, that has not been his position ever.
Right.
But everybody has these fantasies about him. And we can look at this as there's a point where he was at the All In podcast where he surprised a bunch of people of him talking about legal immigration and having visas for people that want to come in.
And I think a lot of the populist right contingent need to be honest and realistic about the fact, too, that he got a ton of money from influential tech individuals who are very supportive of the H-1B program because they get a lot of their engineering talent from that program. And he has to make good on those promises. I mean, just like he had to make good to Miriam Adelson and put people that she wanted in positions of authority in the cabinet. I mean, the American people aren't just going to get everything that they want, and especially every faction of voters not going to get everything they want from the situation.
And the thing is, it's like... That's not what Trump wants. Like, right. Trump Trump himself, he's hired H-1B workers before. You know, he's gone through this process. I think he wants to reform the process, make it better, because that's kind of Trump's classic MO. It's just like, let's make it better. Mm-hmm. You know, let's make America great.
Yeah.
Right? But it hasn't, his positioning has never been this zero immigration take that the internet Twitter warriors are claiming it's been.
Right.
And that's the issue here, where it's like, because I had people telling me that I'm out of step with the Overton window by thinking that there should be like more than one immigrant or something.
Well, you're out of step from the base.
Yeah, I'm out of step with the base. And that's why Elon has to be purged. He's a bastard that needs to get rid of. Vivek is some Pajit that just needs to go. Like this is the type of dynamic that I'm having is that they should all be deported. We should deport Elon Musk. This is the Twitter warrior conversation right now.
This is just right? This is just woke right to me. It's mm-hmm. It's brown people bad.
Just how like dare the, you just use like their
the
words.
Left just like the left said white people bad. This is just brown people bad, and it's fucking moronic.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I think and once again, Steele Manning, the populist nationalist position is it doesn't matter the race of the person who is an immigrant here. Even though there's a lot of racist rhetoric.
Everything is going to Indians right now, but like they...
That's because they are the overwhelming recipients of H-1B by 70%, right? They're 70% of all H-1B.
But they're also a billion population.
Yeah.
Right? Right. There's that too.
And an ethnic minority in the United States that overperforms dramatically the white population. Now, the white population has a more diverse economic background and a more diverse geographic area. If you're more consolidated in urban areas, you're going to have very poor and very rich. While if you're more rural, you're going to lean towards poor because on average, rural people make less money. So, and just to remind everybody, and this isn't Kyle just talking out of nowhere. This is what Trump said on that podcast, real quick.
What I want to do and what I will do is you graduate from a college. I think you should get automatically as part of your diploma, a green card to be able to stay in this country. Somebody graduates at the top of the class. They can't even make a deal with a company because they don't think they're going to be able to stay in the country. That is going to end on day one.
Right. Now, note, that is more radical than H-1B. A green card is 10 years in country with an easier path to citizenship than H-1B. So he is actually far more radical than even Elon is here.
Because I think he understands that America foundationally is a country of immigrants, mm-hmm. right? Like on my mom's side, my great grandfather was an immigrant from Scotland, mm-hmm. you know, to British Columbia actually, and then came to Washington State. You know, like
I love how I get pointed at because it's my Canada,
my dad's side, Irish immigrants. You know, so it's like, yeah, I was pointing you for
is
Canada.
That racist? Is that racist?
No, because you're no,
they all look
you're white.
The same.
You guys all look the same as me. but really, though, like if Trump's mission is to make America great, then it is foolish to turn away great people from other countries who want to come here
steal
and
them.
Who want exactly. It's like as if we don't, everyone else is, mm-hmm. right? It's competitive. Like regardless of your desire to be protectionist for this portion of the Republican right to want to be protectionist in all these ways, it is a global marketplace. Mm-hmm. That just is the world that we live in. And we may want to resist the globalist, you know, tendencies to try to make the nation less independent and less strong and free to exert its own will and for ourselves to exert our own will on our own government. But we can't just change the reality of the fact that we live in a global market.
So the other economic argument being made by the populist nationalist faction or the protectionist nationalist, which might be a better word, is immigrants drive down domestic labor. Now, we looked at that in terms of that specific demographic, that slice, but they're saying in aggregate, more immigration means lower wages. The problem with that is that the classical economic model doesn't necessarily suggest that because they're not simply a good, right? You don't just, they also demand resources too.
Right.
So when you're here as an immigrant, you buy iPhones whose software is made by other immigrants, and Americans, your total demand
made
also increases as you, as you import labor. you also increase demand for goods and services.
And if you're doing a good job, if you're producing a product that is in demand, the labor that comes in produces a product that could be demanded by the whole world, which creates more value and brings more prosperity mm-hmm. back to the United States.
Mm-hmm. And solves more problems. That's the important thing there, right? So we if you look at production simply as the making of things, it's easy to dismiss. But if you look at production of things as solving people's problems, problems for entertainment, or if it's software, whatever the thing is that you're making, right, that solves someone's, I need a health tracker that does a better job for this thing, or I need a food tracker, I need whatever the thing is that you're solving for, that those things themselves are helping people become more prosperity, because that's what prosperity is, your ability to access goods and services that solve your problems. Now, people come in and say, like, well, we don't need these problems solved, right, as the solution to that, right? They're saying, like, well, we have enough now. The problem with that fixed thinking is that is FDR's fixed thinking. We've already succeeded. All the good problems have been solved. We don't have any more problems. And that's where that expansionist vision, that like we're going to Mars, we're going to do things, we're going to manufacture in space, we're going to, you know, bring internet to the world, or whatever the other thing is. We're going to have better healthcare through DNA analysis, or we're going to, whatever the entrepreneurial effort is, that demand curve is infinite. So, and that's another, you know, so two fundamental lessons of economics you have to build into your moral and economic thinking is that scarcity exists and is universal. It is our exception to scarcity that solves problems for people that is the reason why economics exists. So why we do things and build things and work and do stuff to solve problems for each other. And then third, the demand curve for problems to solve is infinite. Right, because as soon as you solve that problem, you get a whole new set of problems to solve for.
God, it's just like endless homework.
Yeah, but that's why it's not. That's why you don't just work, become wealthy, and then stop.
Right,
right. As a society, even as you become wealthy, you just find new problems to solve for, and then the problem is there. And this is the Christian nationalist criticism: is well, then you end up doing more and more things, right, which can lead you astray from God. Right. Mm. Then your problem becomes I'm bored, so here's porn. You know, yeah. Like it to keep you entertained.
Sure. Well, I was just going to ask, but I think you just answered it. Like, is this a sort of a conservative reaction? Basically saying, people saying, oh, we're good with what we have, like, or what we had. Like, we don't want any of the new stuff because we're afraid of change, or the new stuff we've had so far hasn't been good. So we just want to, like, keep it the way it was.
Yes. I've also had, and this has been part of the internet dialogue, and I've seen a lot of people saying this, is just like, good luck getting to Mars now, buddy. Like, saying to Elon, it's just like there's this energy that I'm feeling. And one, it's just there's this really resentful energy, and you can feel it. Like mm-hmm. it's completely uninspiring. Everybody is just like whiny bitches on Twitter right now, and it's just like you do not want to be a part of it. Like it's uninspiring. Like a movement cannot go on that for long with just whiny, resentful energy. It's going to be self-destructive if it continues.
Well, that's why wokeism is dying. Right?
Exactly.
It had
a shelf life of like a decade, right? Yeah. Like, and then it's gone. And then this overtook it. And if you want to be just the next whiny bitches of the world, then we're going to have a shelf life of this thing for a decade. This big tent will crumble. Civil war will tear it apart. We're not going to do cool things like going to Mars, you know? And yeah. Like,
or another one, like you censored me. Tech world, you did things I didn't like. You introduced AI, which got rid of jobs. You're doing all these things I don't like. Therefore, you don't deserve your H-1B visas.
Well, and that's another thing, is this like combination of everyone in the tech world is the same entity mm-hmm. that's happening right now. Like the Laura Loomers of the world is like, I listened to her in Twitter Spaces last night, and it's just like, it's infuriating. And she would ask questions of like, who in tech are you talking about? And she's just like, well, tech censored me. It was like, yes, but tech also brought you back, because there was a civil war that happened in tech.
Right.
Little tech won back. And you know who like dominantly is part of little tech in the comeback? Indian Americans, right? Mm-hmm. They're a dominant force, especially in the philosophical upbringing that's coming. People like Balaji Srinivasan, people like that. They're in kind of that Mark Andreessen, Peter Thiel like sphere of the philosophy, and they're like coming up with their own philosophies, and they're resisting kind of this the transhumanist Satanist types that are existing and kind of culting up in the tech world in Silicon Valley that are that were enforcing all of the DEI woke programs. Like people like that, they're actively saying, yeah, there needs to be criminal charges and federal investigations brought forward on violations of law that DEI programs were making, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're actively saying these things and going to war with kind of the big tech entities, and those big tech entities that were part of the problems, they're facing massive layoffs and changes happening internally right now. They're getting rid of all of their programs that resulted in this because there's been like community takeovers and like CEO takeovers and like cultural takeovers that are happening in that space. So just being like, well, tech censored us. It's like, you're not grappling with the issues that are happening right now at all.
Yeah. Additionally, the case from the right has always been that DEI is an artificial construct of government and leftist funding. It isn't a market phenomena. So when she's looking at using market phenomena as an argument for why they shouldn't exist, right, or why they're the bad guy, it removes the culpability of government in enforcing DEI, right? And government in the terms of which ESG funds DEI, which all has all and the downstream effects that we've covered.
The thing: who brought ESG to the forefront? It was Vivek. Vivek is the guy that brought it to the forefront all of this.
As a problem. Yeah.
He's the one that wrote the book before it was popular to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Before, like, I was talking about ESGs and the DEI, you know, aspect of this to people back in 2018, and people thought I was a nut job talking about this. Like, and part of it was like, I read Vivek's book because like somebody recommended it to me, and I was just like, this is kind of like the stuff that you were talking about, and I was like, oh my god, this guy understands it. And he was saying this long before he ran for president, and he was talking about these things. It was Vivek that did that. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Woke Inc. was the book, right?
Woke Inc. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting because I'm seeing since the election, I'm seeing this in multiple different arenas within sort of the big tent.
Civil War.
Another one is in the health space, and I just suffered through this podcast with a guy who I really respect, and Callie Means, who, you know, Callie and Casey Means, that, you know, they wrote a book recently. They're all about food and mm-hmm. you know, improving the pharmaceutical industry, you know, basically tearing it open, radical transparency.
Big part of
stuff.
The RFK Trump collaboration.
Right. Yeah. But there are people within the new health movement who would have on, you know, November 4th agreed and been, you know, rallying together that we need to elect Trump so that we can get all these things done through RFK and all the other things, who are now bickering and fighting and saying, oh, well, you're not championing my cause hard enough, and this is the important one, and so you're my enemy now. How much of this is just the faction sort of vying for control, you know, in the administration ahead of the inauguration, and how much of this is maybe more real irreconcilable differences that are coming to the forefront
point? How much of it might just be psyoping?
And that.
Too.
How many, you know, agent provocateurs are there maybe who were, you know, sleepers up to this point who are now injecting some of these toxic ideas to pit people against each other and tear the movement apart?
Well, it's just like, look, we've gone through months of the regime trying to split Elon and Trump apart.
Right.
Through whatever means necessary. That's been going on right now. And now there's this instance which is kind of separating. The funny thing is, it's separating Elon and the base. It's not separating Elon and Trump.
Yeah.
Like, I think the goal is to separate Elon and Trump, but that doesn't seem to be working. Because the fact is, Trump's more on Elon and Vivek's side on this.
Right.
Right.
So I think this is the first fight in a lot of fights we're going to see. Glenn Greenwald had this interesting note, because that is how, like, this is a civil war, you know, that's why I put a question mark at the start, kind of narrative has gone into the mainstream, where CNN's talking about this as the mega coalition's falling apart, right?
Of course.
And it's because the progressives are so monolithic, they can't understand, you know, that this phenomenon would happen in
that
public.
A movement can have multiple different viewpoints, right, that may be at contrast at times.
That is the thing, is the people on the left are having a hard time grappling with this, as they just, like, it is falling apart because they are so monolithic. And that is kind of a funny dynamic that we're watching here, is this is the nature of having a big tent. There's multiple factions within that tent. Now, the Democrats have their factions, whatever, but, like, they're very suppressed, and the Republicans are much more open with the factional divides, and those, and Twitter is a battleground for those divides to happen.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So is this a good
and
thing?
Elon's allowing it to happen.
Well, this is the example. Sorry, Joe, but this is Kyle Griffin. He's the executive producer of MSNBC, of the weekend MSNBC program. He says MAGA diehards are already attacking Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, and Trump isn't even in office yet. And Glenn Greenwald responds with, media liberals still can't comprehend that Trump supporters, whom they have relentlessly depicted as a blindly loyal leader worshiping fascist cult, have actual ideological and policy differences they air. It's Democrats who march in lockstep with virtually no dissent.
Right.
And I think that's true.
And that's like them importing what they expect from their own side onto the right, when that's not ever been what the right has ever been.
Right.
Right. Even in the Bush administration, there was enormous differences within the right on trying to determine priority values, all that kind of stuff. It's always been a coalition. We shouldn't expect there not to be disagreements in that area, just like we don't expect them in Democrats right now. Just because you're in power doesn't mean you all walk in lockstep. Now, 2 seconds ago, everyone did expect that, in the sense of when the budget fight happened, there was universal condemnation of anyone saying how this Christmas omnibus was a bad idea from the fiscal conservatives, and a lot of MAGA said, "How dare you go back on Trump on this issue?" Because he's endorsed doing this with Speaker Johnson, right? So that exists on the right too. Like, they're expecting lockstep on some things, just not this thing. Because I think that's widely understood. There was always a divide between the vision of the pure immigration restrictionists and the tech world and the libertarian side of the MAGA movement, and how that disagreement is going to happen is going to happen in public, because there's too many economics to not do it, right? We're engaging in it. Everyone else is engaging on it, because this is how you come to consensus when you don't have an elitist power control dynamic, which we don't, which just as doesn't exist in the right. Never has.
Yeah.
Well, and it is interesting, because, and part of this is just thanks to Elon, the Twitter space, the Twitter world exists right now, and we can see this all out in the air and watch and participate in the dialogue in a way that we've never seen before too. Mm-hmm. And that in itself is just an interesting dynamic, because we did watch during the omnibus stuff, we watched during Pompeo. That is like, we saw the internet, you know, cult come together and fight against it, to the point where Trump had to deny that. So like, we watched this like very fluid motion of factions kind of coming in and out of favor with each other. And it's honestly something that should be like studied, right? Of how these factions split off, they come back together, they split off, come back together, they all mob up in one instance for one common goal, then they split apart to debate another thing. And it's interesting how that all works out, right?
Yeah.
And I am curious how much of it is manipulated, because we know that, you know, the censorship industrial complex works in those avenues of building consensus around issues they want to push and building dissent around issues they want to kill. I am curious what amount of influence there is around this issue.
I am seeing a lot of people making claims that Elon is censoring people on Twitter right now too. I have not seen anything that didn't seem to violate Twitter terms of service as currently stands in some of the cases that I looked at. Like, a lot of people are making claims about things, and I'm not seeing it, and I'm open to seeing it. I haven't personally, like, the examples that have been put forward to me were violations of TOS.
Yeah. There's also an update to the algorithm, which has had changes on monetization, all these other things, on authentication. Maybe it's weaker at group reporting now. I don't know. I know my algorithm isn't as good as it was, used to be. I'm getting a lot of stuff I've already seen. So I don't know what's going on.
I'm getting a lot of that too. Yeah.
Around the same time as Christmas, an algorithm update that maybe result in these things. Or Elon is the king and he's just saying, censor this person. We don't know. Those things are possible. We just don't have any evidence either way at the moment.
It's funny too, because we were talking about this before, Dave, where like there's a guy that sounds kind of like Elon who has over 100,000 Twitter followers. His name's Adrian Dittman, and he does Twitter spaces, and people keep thinking that he's Elon. So people are like using him, and he went on like a big rant, and people are using that as footage of like, we found Elon's alt and he's unhinged right now. And it's just like, he's just not Elon. Like, him and Elon have existed on Twitter spaces together and had conversations. Now, if you want to think that it's like Elon on one phone and then Elon with a slightly voice changer on another phone going back and forth talking to each other, like,
without any feedback,
you can assume that that's an interesting theory, but it's definitely not the case. Because it was his space that I was, and it was funny because I was listening to his space last night, which Laura Loomer was on, and she kept calling him Elon. and he had to keep saying that he's not Elon.
Oh my God. We need them in the same room talking to each other on video to prove that this is the case.
But like, there's a lot of that type of stuff that's happening where I'm seeing a lot of disingenuous practices coming in the populist right now. Yeah. on this argument. It's just like, it's the classic thing when you mob up, like, you're going to see this. It's always going to happen with mobs of any sort, but it's just, be wary of that, as a lot of the things that are being pushed around right now, they're not real. Mm-hmm. At all. Like, a lot of fake Elon tweets that are being pushed around too, right. Which was one of the people that got censored because he put forward a fake Elon tweet as a screenshot and being like, Elon deleted this, and it was proven to be fake. And then that guy got, that is a violation of TOS. So he, right. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, I don't even think TOS hit him. I think he actually just deleted his account.
Hmm. Oh,
afterwards.
So a lot of this drama is circling around. And this is a bad part of this. The downside to publicly debating it is you get entry of a lot of people who are bad faith actors in that.
Yes.
Maybe they're psyops or whatever, but maybe they're just, you know, people who are shitty at this and they engage in, you know, manipulative practices that throw things off and make things worse. Right. For example, some of that could be like the racism stuff. Otherwise, it could be like misrepresenting evidence. So one of the examples are those screenshots of applications as if they were how H-1B is actually being used, as if they were actual H-1B visa holders, right?
Right. Those are
manipulative
tactics.
The hairstylist is actually that. Now, that could just be an honest mistake, right? They thought they were looking at H-1B holders, but they were actually looking at H-1B proposals and thought they were the same thing.
But then it's a cycle, right? Because then people are posting those same screenshots that other people took, and it just keeps going, and it becomes a narrative of its own, which that is part of warfare. And this is where kind of like, you know,
his name's Dan.
Mike Cernovich, like the people that are much more guerrilla, the guerrilla mindset, people that are much more like, it's just about the game theory. There's wars going on. We got to clean things out. We got to try to push out the fake people. And, you know, there might be some of that there. Like, there probably are people in the tech side that are kind of fakes, mm-hmm. and they're using the movement in such a way. I don't necessarily think that I would put Vivek and Elon or like David Sachs or people like that as part of that.
What standard of evidence do you use to decide that they're fake, right? I mean, if you could say a pattern of behavior, yeah, but who are the major influencers that you're talking about? Or are you doing what you're accusing everyone else of doing, which is using the fringe cases of you know, fakes to define the larger arc narrative and story?
Well, it's like I'm seeing, because David Sachs, he became the AI and crypto czar under the Trump administration, and he's getting a bunch of people from Silicon Valley underneath him to work on that stuff. And he has been the lone conservative voice in Silicon Valley for decades. Mm-hmm. And he has been the only person that's kind of been in that bulwark for so long, and he still funded Republican causes, all this stuff. He was the major, him and Chamath Palihapitiya, Indian, by the way.
No, actually, he's from Sri Lanka.
South of India.
South Asian.
Sure. South Asian is accurate. Indian is not.
Sri Lankan and Indian, they're very close. Okay. Like, there's a lot of togetherness that exists.
Whatever,
there,
right? You're wrong. Continue.
Whatever. They were the linchpin in bringing the tech world and the MAGA world together. Like, again, the Trump clip that we pulled was from the All In podcast, which is their podcast, mm-hmm. right? So, like, there's a lot of those dynamics there. And it's just like, if you're criticizing those guys as being fake, like, I don't know what to tell you, man. Like,
yeah. One last part of that I think is important to note is I think there's an emotional level component here of sympathy for the American worker and what they've gone through that is defining most of the conflict. You know, the American worker has had these enormous tax burdens, enormous inflationary burdens, all of these challenges. So, and I just want to note that that instinct is perfectly fine. The question is how to solve that problem, right? How to relieve the burden on the American worker, and is immigration the appropriate place to do that?
Right.
And I think that's most of where we're at. We want to shift this burden of the American worker away from immigration being the major issue, legal immigration, and towards illegal immigration, and towards inflation, spending, regulations, all those things.
Taxation, yeah.
And, yeah.
I completely agree, and I was going to raise that very point, so I'm glad that you did. If the American economy was actually really prospering right now, if the government wasn't so bloated and so restrictive to business, the economy in general, if inflation wasn't so freaking high from all the money printing that's been going on, I'm not sure we'd even be having this conversation, because a few legal immigrants who are coming here as highly skilled workers to do value-adding jobs that we need people to do wouldn't be a factor, wouldn't be a drop in the bucket. Mm-hmm. And so I think those are the issues that we really need to focus on.
Beyond the emotional case of the native's right to a job and those kind of dialogues that still need to be, I think, vetted out on the right. We have to decide, do we believe FDR or not? Right? Are we Rawlsians or are we Lockeans? Right? Do you believe that it's your property and you can do what you want with it and the government doesn't have a say? Or do you believe that the state has to direct the purpose of your property so that it benefits the state interests?
Yeah. Those are great questions. And
big part with the Civil War is.
We would love your feedback. Where do you fall on this issue? Drop us a comment below. Join the Discord. Get in on the conversation over there with all of us and all of our amazing members. Thank you guys so much for watching. We appreciate you very much. For David Rand, Kyle Mack, and Bennett, who is not here. Thanks, buddy. Love you. I'm Joe Sheehan. This is Human Reaction. We'll see you next time. Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.